This is NHL Midweek,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
On the backside, and Dustin Byfuglien got back to knock the puck away. Back at the line for Josi. Josi's long shot, score! No! They're waving it off. They say it got deflected in with a high stick.
After reviewing the play, the call on the ice has been overturned. If the puck was not high-sticked in, we have a goal.
1-0, the Nashville Predators. You'll see the wrist shot. That went wide. Arvidsson in front of the net. Forsberg scores! Philip Forsberg pulls it back and between his legs, flips it up as he was left alone at the side of the net. Forsberg's second of the night, and the Nashville Predators have a 3-0 lead.
It was not a good night last night for fans of the Winnipeg Jets. It started poorly 1 minute and 2 seconds into the first period with Victor Arvidsson's goal. It got worse from there. The Predators with a 4-0 Game 6 victory at Bell MTS Place last night, raining on the parade of Jets fans inside the arena and outside at the street party. Good evening, Winnipeg. Good evening, Manitoba. And for all those joining us live this evening at TSN1290.ca and via the iHeartRadio app, we welcome you to NHL This Week with Illegal Curve Hockey. Alongside Ezra Ginsberg and Sean Asora, I'm your host, Drew Mandel. We're with you for the next 2 hours as we'll get you set for everything to do with the Jets and the Predators, looking back at last night's Game 6, disappointing Game 6, and getting you set for the epic clash Thursday night, Game 7 between the Jets and the Preds. Sean, Ezzy, it's sort of fitting. It started with a best of 7. We knew before the best of 7 even began how evenly matched and how close these two teams were. Then it was a best of 5, and then it was a best of 3, and Jets fans were happy. We're going to win it on home ice. We have a good chance on home ice for the second consecutive night at home. The Jets haven't shown up, and or the Predators have been the better of the two teams. It's now down to a single game elimination. Winner takes all Thursday night to see who's going to meet the Vegas Golden Knights in the Western Conference Finals.
Yeah, pretty demoralizing game if you're a Jets fan, guys. But, you know, as you said, Drew, we have a single game elimination coming up on Thursday night. And, you know, I'm probably more so a glass half full type of guy. But, you know, a lot of people are going to point to that early goal by Victor Arvidsson. It looked like it was going to be disallowed because it was a high stick, but then it was reviewed and it turns out that it was a good goal. And, you know, the Jets had those three power plays early on in the first period. They were unable to capitalize on any of those power plays. You know, I think a lot of people are now maybe thinking that the Predators have all of the momentum right now, but I really don't think there has been any carryover of momentum from game to game right now. I think it's anybody's series, but, you know, it was a disappointing game. I thought the Jets had some scoring chances and some good opportunities, Drew. You look back at that first period, Paul Stastny had a really good chance on the power play. He actually had two really good looks on the power play. You look at that second period, Mark Scheifele and Blake Wheeler have a 2-on-1. You know, Scheifele's stopped by Pecorine, a really nice blocker save. So it's not like the Jets played a bad game. The Predators were the better team last night. And as you mentioned, you know, the series is tied again. We thought this was going to go to 6 or 7 games this series. And, you know, you hope that they're able to kind of rekindle that magic from Game 5 in which they exploded in that second period. So realize it was a little depressing for Jets fans last night leaving Bell MTS Place and leaving the street party, but they have just as good a chance as the Predators of winning the series.
Absolutely. You know, it's sort of, Sean, that Game 5, you look back to Saturday night, and the Jets' best players were the best players in that game. And then last night, the Predators' best players, their top line. I mean, Arvidsson, 2 goals and an assist. Philip Forsberg, 2 goals and an assist. Ryan Johansson, 2 assists. Roman Josi, 2 assists. The Predators' best players were the best players when their backs were right up against the wall in Game 6 last night. And now it's the heavyweights on both teams have sort of laid their claim over Game 5 and Game 6, and it all comes down, boiling down to a Game 7 back in Nashville on Thursday night.
Yeah, you said it, Drew. Game 5 highlighted by, you know, the Kyle Connor show, the 2 goals, the spectacular assist, and then flip it to Game 6, home ice, and it was that top line of Johansson, Arvidsson, Forsberg. How about the skill of Philip Forsberg? This
disgusting
guy, what he's able to do, not just in this series, we've seen it throughout the entire postseason. The skill and the strength at which he's able to do it, fighting off defenders left, right, and center. I mean, that the first goal regardless, fighting off Ben Sherrod after he breaks a stick, grabs goes back to the bench, quick handoff, and fights off Sherrod for the goal. And then the second one, I mean, what more can you say about a guy who's taking a puck off the wall, puts it in between his legs, and puts it past a goaltender? I mean, what we've been seeing out of Phil Forsberg has been tremendous.
Yeah, well, both goals were equally beautiful. And, of course, the first goal that Arvidsson scored, the goal that made it 2-0 Nashville, I mean, he just beats Ben Sherrod. He uses his body positioning. Mm-hmm. And then it was, a really smart decision of Craig Smith to flip the puck up to Forsberg. And then he beats Sherrod. And Sherrod was about to take a penalty. But, I mean, he's diving. Let's be honest here. I mean, Connor Hellebuck played pretty well. I mean, none of these goals were Connor Hellebuck's fault. Mm-hmm. And, the goal that he scores in the third period, it's between the legs. I mean, Forsberg's left alone in front of the Jets net. And I actually thought that the Jets played pretty well defensively, and we talked about it. I mean, this game was fairly even. Even when the game was 2-0, the Jets were in this game. But, they couldn't beat Pekka-Rinne. He's been excellent in the last two games at Bell MTS Place. He wasn't good, obviously, in Game 5 being pulled for UC Saros. But, Pekka-Rinne's had some good games. He's had some bad games. I still think Hellebuck's been the better goaltender of the two. But the reality is, guys, it comes down to a Game 7 single-game elimination. And if you ask me, and again, I think you guys would agree, I don't think either team has the advantage right now. Yes, it'll be tough for the Jets to win three games at Bridgestone Arena, but they've managed to do it. And in Game 5, when we kind of thought that the Jets might be done there and the Predators might have the momentum, turned out that the Jets came out with that great second period and exploded offensively. So I would still be very optimistic if I were a Jets fan right now in Winnipeg.
The one thing that a little bit was concerning to me in the first period, and you touched on the 0-for-3 for the power plays in the first, but was the ability, we touch again on this top line, of Ryan Johansson to win key faceoffs in the defensive zone that allowed the Predators to clear themselves out of any danger. I mean, the Jets were having trouble setting up to begin with, but if you win a faceoff in the offensive zone, it's much easier to set up whatever power play you're looking to set up. But the ability for Nashville to win those key draws and clear the zone without putting their goaltender or themselves in any danger, I thought was really, really crucial.
Yeah, the Predators definitely were good in on the face-off side of the game, especially the key face-offs in last night's contest. And, you talk about Connor Hellebuck and his performance last night, Ezzy. You're right. I mean, none of those goals you can really fault him for. And truthfully, besides the take away the empty netter, but besides the three goals that the Predators scored...
Well, I hope we're taking away the empty netter.
Yeah, well, I mean...
Connor Hellebuck doesn't have much of a chance when he's not in the net.
Obviously. Take the empty netter out of the equation. And the Predators didn't really have what I would describe as very many other scoring opportunities. They were very opportunistic when they had the chance. Aside from Craig Smith, there was the one big save on Craig Smith in the second period. The Predators didn't have a ton of opportunities, but they also bottled up the Jets, just like we saw in Game 4 at Bell MTS Place, where the Jets could get nothing going and they couldn't get their speed game going. Pekka-Rinne, made the saves he needed to make last night, but I don't know how many of those saves were what I would describe as fantastic opportunities. Probably the Paul Stastny one on the power play mm-hmm. when the Jets were trailing were the Jets' best opportunities of the game. But aside from that, the Predators did a tremendous job keeping the Jets outside of the dangerous areas. I mean, I know the Jets ended up with, 34 shots on goal, but a lot of that were relatively insignificant shots from the outside that didn't really have a chance of really turning into a scoring opportunity.
I just want to go back to just how even this series has been.
This is the tweet that I'm sure you're going to be referencing that everybody saw last night.
Right, and I know you guys have seen some of these numbers, but in six games, the Jets have scored 22 goals. The Predators have scored 18. Each team in this series is 1-2 at home. No team has won two consecutive games in this series. Even strength shot attempts, 338 each, which is mind-boggling.
that in a six-game series,
they have the same amount of even strength shot attempts.
Mm-hmm.
Even strength shots, 177 each. Even strength goals, the Predators have the 12-11 advantage. Even strength high danger chances, which is a very telling stat, Drew.
Mm-hmm.
66-65 for the Jets. I mean, it's almost eerie.
It is uncanny that a series that everybody is said beforehand was going to be close, and you say, well, these two teams are very competitive, and it's a toss-up as to which team can be better.
The stats back it up.
The stats after six games of it,
right,
back it up to the point of, yeah, it's a game seven on Thursday night, and yeah, it's a coin flip. I mean, I think right now I looked at some of the numbers, and I think the Predators have a 55-45 prediction advantage, you know, like in terms of when you crunch some of the numbers and you factor in home ice advantage and everything else along those ends. And that's all fine and good, but 55-45 is no real statistical advantage.
Well, and home ice has not been an advantage, right?
Because each team has won twice on the opposing team's rink.
Right, and home ice advantage has changed three times now, right? Because the Jets took home ice advantage after they won game one.
Yeah.
And then Nashville took it back after they won game four.
Yeah.
And then Winnipeg took it back after they won game five, right?
And so, Nashville took it back after they won game six.
I really don't think you can give, even if it's a 51% edge, I really don't think you can give any team an advantage. It's been that close.
It has been that close. It's going to be, I mean,
and unpredictable.
Yeah. And what really boils down to is the desperation factor. Game one, you could say the Jets maybe were the more desperate team to get off to a good start, so they got the victory. Game two, Nashville scores in overtime. It was a very close contest, but they can't go down 2-0. They're desperate. They get the win. Game three, the Jets on home ice. They want the win. They get the win. More desperate. Game four, the Predators. Obviously, they can't go down 3-1. They get the win in Bell MTS Place. Game five, same thing with the Jets, want to sort of reaffirm themselves. Game six, well, obviously the Predators were more desperate last night because they were playing, fighting for their lives. It was an elimination game.
And now both teams are desperate.
Now both teams, right, are desperate. So yep, if you can tell me what's going to happen on Thursday night, I mean, are you going to see the Nashville Predators team on home ice that swallowed up the Winnipeg Jets defensively? Well, they haven't been able to play that way in Bridgestone Arena. So are you going to see the Winnipeg Jets team that's been an offensive juggernaut that we've seen in Nashville that we haven't seen in two out of the three games in Winnipeg? Well, maybe you are. I mean, it's that close, and anybody who's, you know, the next 48 hours are all going to be filled with speculation and hyperbole, because this series, which is the only series in the second round to go seven games, has been everything everyone said it would be at the outset. An absolute epic between the Predators and the Jets for the right to meet the Vegas Golden Knights in the conference final. When we come back, we're going to preview Game 7. It's Thursday night. You know that. 7 o'clock. You listen to it here.
Thank God it's an early start. Earlier in the series, boys, I didn't mind the 8:30 start, but last night,
yeah,
when I looked at my phone and it was 10:30 during the second intermission.
You're struggling there, big boy? A little late for you? Need a little nappy?
Well, everybody has to go to work. At least most of us have to go to work the next day. It was a Monday night, right?
I know.
But,
hey,
I mean, don't get me wrong. It was fun, but I'm thankful that it's going to be a 7 o'clock start.
You know, neither Sean nor I nor Rory have any sympathy for you, because you were definitely curled up in bed by about 11:30, 11:40, and that for us who were working the game last night, you were there obviously with Naomi, with your wife.
I was not in bed at 11:30.
No, you went. You keep pouring a few back after that game?
There was a little celebrating going on. I mean, obviously we weren't.
What were you celebrating?
We weren't celebrating a Jets win, but we were, you know, just celebrating life.
Celebrating life, L'chaim, as they say.
Celebrating a new caravan.
You're listening at New Caravan. You're listening to NHL This Week. We're live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is NHL Midweek,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Shifley on the forehand, save, rebound. Kyle Connor scores. Kyle Connor, after Shifley got stopped by Pekarete, in tight. Kyle Connor has his first NHL playoff goal. Subban being watched by Wheeler, plays it up the boards. Bufflin holds the line though. Bufflin has Wheeler in front. In for Kyle Connor. How did that not go in, or did it? Yes. Kyle Connor has scored again, and the Winnipeg Jets have a 4-1 lead.
The one, the only, Dennis Bayak with the call, that from Saturday night's Game 5, the Kyle Connor breakout show, as the Jets took a then 3-2 series lead. We all know what happened last night, but it is fitting with these two competitive teams. It is going to go seven. It'll go seven on Thursday night. And, well, I can't see for any reason why it won't be quite as dramatic as the first six have been. And so settle in, buckle up. It'll be a good one on Thursday night, a game you can hear live on TSN 1290. This segment of the show brought to you by our good friend Dr. Les Rikus and the team at Linden Market Dental Center, official dentist of Illegal Curve Hockey. Don't be an Ezzy. Always wear a mouth guard and give yourself peace of mind protection, as well as facial, teeth, and mouth protection. To make an appointment to get your teeth to ting, visit LindenMarketDentalCenter.com. Let me ask you guys this. Game 7, the Jets are coming off a demoralizing victory, if you believe it is demoralizing. I guess that could be one of the questions to begin with.
I think it's temporarily demoralizing.
Interesting. like temporary paralysis.
I really don't think – that's funny, Drew. I really don't
except
think –
if you're the one paralyzed, it's probably not funny.
I mean, these guys don't hold on to a loss. Today, the Jets were not talking about it, or at least they weren't fixating on it.
Sure.
So it was demoralizing for fans, and I think fans are probably carrying that baggage a little bit more in the office today. But I think the Jets are going to forget about that one, and now their focus is winning Game 7. I really do believe that.
Can the Winnipeg Jets win Game 7 with the power play as listless as it was in Game 6? I mean, you forget now, or maybe you don't, but the Jets had three power play opportunities within an 8-minute span of that game in the first period. Ample opportunity to tie the game. They were trailing 1-0. Mattias Ekholm takes a puck over the glass penalty at the 8:54 mark. 6 minutes later, Austin Watson takes a penalty. And then really 30 seconds after his penalty expires, Yannick Weber takes a tripping penalty. So you have 8 minutes where the Predators are, or 6 out of 8 minutes where the Predators are shorthanded. And not that the Jets even, I mean, how many scoring opportunities did they have there? They had trouble even setting up on the power play last night. It was the Jets for the entire game, I would say, looked a step slow, maybe a step slow to loose pucks, and it showed during the power play when the Predators often won the puck battles last night during that first period stretch. Ezzy, you're nodding. Ezzy, you're sort of shaking your head.
Well,
so
I think
please.
You're oversimplifying a little bit. Listen, okay. The Nashville Predators penalty kill was aggressive. It was absolutely aggressive, and it was effective. I didn't think the Jets looked really good on that first power play. You mentioned Mattias Ekholm takes that puck over the glass penalty, Drew. You know how much I hate that penalty.
I do know that.
But they're not taking it out ever. No. So I don't know why I still hate it. It just bothers me.
Yeah.
I thought the Jets' second and third power plays were much better. And we mentioned that chance that Paul Stastny had. The Jets worked it down low. And we know that they're on that Jets' first power play, there are no shortage of weapons, sure. Right? You have Patty Laine out there. We know where his sweet spot is. They can go to him for the one-timer. They can go to Mark Scheifele in the slot. And Paul Stastny was the one that was kind of in that position where Mark Scheifele likes to be. And Pekka Rinne made a great save. And Dennis Bayak talked about it on the broadcast. He thought, you know, maybe Stastny didn't get all of it, but he did get all of it. So I thought
Stastny
the puck
looked a little surprised that it got to him. I mean, if you watch the replay, it was on his stick almost before he was completely expecting it.
Right, and that's partly because, you know, that's Mark Scheifele's usual spot in the first power play unit, but I thought that the Jets were moving the puck a lot better on the power play in the second and third attempts, because you mentioned they had the three power play chances there. And, you know, sure, could they have moved the puck a little bit quicker, Drew? Sure. And were the Predators maybe winning some of those individual battles? Absolutely. I agree. I thought Ryan Johansson looked really effective on the penalty kill, and he was effective at 5-on-5 as well. And I thought, you know, you had to give the Jets a lot of credit. For the majority of the game, they stayed out of the penalty box. I don't think they're getting enough credit for how disciplined they've been in this series.
They took the one penalty after the Predators scored the empty net goal. Bufflin took a roughing penalty.
Yeah, and the game's over.
Was over, so it was a meaningless penalty, absolutely. I'm surprised they gave Bufflin the penalty, but Laine got away with sort of chipping the puck at
Laine was the one that I thought was going to get the penalty.
So did
I agree, but we both agree that it's meaningless.
At that point in time.
Back to the power play. I mean, I have no worries about the power play in Game 7, and to answer your question, I mean, I absolutely think the power play could have a huge impact on the outcome of the game. The Jets scoring on the power play could have a huge impact on the game, especially if the game's close. I mean, the Nashville special teams have been better. We talked about it on Saturday's show.
Yeah.
The PK has been better than the Jets PK, and their power play has been better.
And
not necessarily much better.
And they've got a shorthanded goal as well.
But and you know, we're not talking about, you know, their power play being 10% better, but one or two goals are going to determine the outcome of the series. It's a Game 7 here. So if the Jets get an early power play or a couple of early power plays in the first period, Shawnee, and they're able to bury one, that could be the difference in the game.
Let me ask you this, Sean. As we prepare for Game 7, you're listening to NHL This Week. We're live here on TSN Radio 1290. Do the Jets have any pressure on them entering Thursday's Game 7, or can they play carefree? The expectations at the beginning of the year for the Jets weren't as high as they were for the Predators. Game 7 is in Nashville in front of a home crowd that can easily become a very nervous home crowd if the Jets get off to a good start. Can the Jets play without a monkey on their back, given that if they were to lose Game 7, you would say, for the most part, well, you know, they took they're the second-best team, and they took the best team in the league all the way to a seventh game, and one team one deserving team was probably going to lose this series, and it so happened to be the Jets, but they certainly showed themselves well during the series.
Look, Blake Wheeler said it today, I believe it was to Ken Weeb, that if they were to pose at the beginning of the season...
It was last night, post-game,
if you were to be in the Western Conference semifinals, Game 7 versus the top team in the league, one game to take it all, where would you be? He said he'd kiss him.
Yeah.
So it just goes to show you kind of
not
where...
Not lick him.
Which is a great... Also additive to his response, but this goes to show you kind of where they are mentally. And is there pressure on this team? Absolutely. They see how the city's been affected by this run, and I think it's probably more so externally than internally that they feel that they just don't want to let the city down. And, you know, they all talk about turning their phones off, turning social media off, trying to keep it within, you know, as tight a bubble as they can. But the pressure has to be mounting them from outside. Inside, I assume they're just going to approach it like any other game. We've been hearing that mantra since day one of training camp. Just live in the moment. Try not to let the exterior pressures get to you. But, I mean, naturally, you have to think that they're going in with a little bit of pressure. Is it house money? I mean, they have to be very pleased with what they've accomplished thus far. And, you know, they can definitely... You know, hang their chins high or hold their chins high if they were to lose Game 7, saying, look what we've done, especially going from not being in the postseason to where we've made it this year, and the future's looking almost just as bright. But, I mean, there's got to be some pressure, and I bet you there's going to be some disappointment if they don't proceed.
Right, and the Jets are going to want to take the crowd out of it. And it's a good question, Drew, because, you know, Nashville, they feel the pressure of having to win the Stanley Cup this year or the season is really a bust.
The Jets looked like a team last night on home ice that looked tight.
They didn't want to lose.
Yes, they played not to win, but they didn't want to lose. And they looked tight, and maybe that's why they looked a step slow. I could see Nashville just as easily having that same sort of baggage attached to them prior to Game 7.
Well, look at Pittsburgh. They lost Game 6 on home ice. Right. Yeah. So, I mean, Nashville has pressure. The Jets have pressure. It's obviously subjective who has more pressure or who's going to deal with the pressure. We'll never really know the answer. I mean, even if we find out the outcome, I mean, if Nashville wins, doesn't mean that they necessarily had less pressure or dealt with it more, Drew. But I think
one team's going to win, one team's going to lose regardless. Maybe they both play an excellent game and it comes down to a 3-2 overtime defeat or something.
I really think we're probably going to see one of two games. And we talked about it during the first segment. This series has been so unpredictable. Are we going to see an offensive explosion from the Jets? We've seen them score 4 goals in a period now twice in the series. Or are we going to see that stifling defense of the Nashville Predators? And I realize, again, we might be oversimplifying it, but when the Predators get the lead early and they're able to clog up the neutral zone and kind of play that, for lack of a better word, that kind of trap style of a game, we've seen the Jets get frustrated.
The Predators haven't been able to play that style on home ice. Can they turn it on tomorrow? I think it's a much easier the style to play on the road where you have to play, you know, an ugly road game. But the tendency, especially for skilled teams like the Jets, like the Predators, is when you're on home ice, you want to push the pace. Can the Predators do what they haven't been able to do all series long on home ice, which is slow down the Jets' offense?
Look, I think the Preds did that in game one. That was the one game I thought that they dictated the pace.
And the Jets
and then Hellebuck wouldn't let anything go by him.
And the Jets still scored 4 goals in game one.
Right.
So game two, which the Predators won, the Jets still scored 4 goals.
Yep.
And then game five, which the Jets won, the Jets scored 5 goals. So for a Nashville team that has been so successful bottling the Jets up at Bell MTS Place, they haven't been able to do it in their home arena. And you wonder, if they can't do it tomorrow night, does that give the Jets an advantage? Does
Absolutely.
That play into the Jets' strength of being able to go in a track meet with the Predators?
Yeah, and I think it's going to be crucial for the Jets to score first, just so that it doesn't give the Predators any opportunity to get comfortable in that game that now they've seen execute pretty much to a T twice in this series. Just the ability to get out and just to kind of get them out of that comfort zone, not let them set back into what they've been used to doing and what's been giving them success as of late, I think it's going to be crucial for the Jets. And we talk about power play. Half of that is, you know, how much have we talked about confidence with regards to the power play? If the Jets can get a power play goal early, let's say, I think it's going to work wonders for the road team.
And I think it'll be very interesting to see which Pekka Rinne shows up. Is it the Pekka Rinne that we saw in Game 4 and in Game 6, who was strong, who was stable, who was confident in the Predators' net? Or is it drunk uncle Pekka Rinne, who's flopping all over, who can't gobble up a rebound, who is just sort of a fish out of water. And, I mean, if Pekka Rinne isn't the Game 4 and Game 6 Pekka Rinne, that seems like a strong advantage for the Winnipeg Jets, because Connor Hellebuck, despite giving up some goals in this series that he'd like back, has been the more unflappable of the two goaltenders.
Nikolaj Ehlers needs to step up Game 7.
I would agree with that.
This is his time to make his statement.
And, Shawnee, very similar to Kyle Connor in Game 5, right? He had two beautiful goals, and he had the assist. So, you know, Ehlers hopefully is the new Connor in Game 7, because we know that Connor didn't have a goal going into Game 5 in Nashville, right? And it's kind of shocking that Ehlers hasn't scored yet in the playoffs.
When we come back, Jeff O'Neill joins us to talk more about the Jets Preds. We'll look around the NHL as a whole and, of course, the Stanley Cup playoffs in its entirety. You're listening to NHL This Week. We are live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is NHL Midweek,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
You're listening to a special Tuesday edition of NHL This Week. Drew Mundell, Ezra Ginsberg, Sean Assor with you in studio. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/illegalcurve, and our website with the latest in Winnipeg Jets and Manitoba Moose news and audio is illegalcurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
You know him from TSN 1050 in Toronto. He's the star of Overdrive. And yeah, you can tell the other guys, I said, you're the star, Jeff. He's a good friend of our program. He's Jeff O'Neill. Jeff, welcome back to the show. How you doing?
I'm doing well, guys. How you doing out there?
Doing very well, obviously.
It's been a
bit of a hectic time here in Peg City, as you are well aware. You know, everyone was geared up for last night's Game 6. Did not turn out the way they wanted, but Game 7 gives the Jets and the Jets fans a second opportunity at glory Thursday night back in Nashville. Jeff, having been through so many dramatic games in your career, what are the players doing right now? What's it like to be a player with this sort of extra day and a half before Game 7 on Thursday night? You know, take us through the mindset of a player right now.
Well, I'm sure if you got nicks and bruises, you appreciate the rest, but I'm sure everybody involved on both sides, Nashville and Winnipeg, Nashville probably feeling pretty good about themselves. I'm sure they'd rather get right back at it tomorrow night, but that's not going to be the case. And for Winnipeg, I'm sure they'd want to redeem themselves and get back at them. So it's one of those things. They got to wait for that extra day and see what happens. But it's just like, I think Paul Maurice described it as Christmas. And I don't know what he said, but the guys that, you know, are closer to 5 years old are going to be really nervous about the sleeps. And the other guys that have experienced it are not going to be as nervous. So it's one of those things. It's like any other pressure situation. You got to go out there. And I talked to Justin Williams about this last week. He said, you got to go out there and make yourself feel comfortable and with the ability to make a play in a critical situation, as opposed to being nervous of what you're going to do is going to affect the game negatively. So that's the way you have to approach it. So whichever team can go out there and be the most relaxed and make the most plays under pressure is the team that's going to win. It's difficult to do because you're going out there thinking, man, if this play doesn't work, maybe my team will lose. But you can't do it. You can't be afraid to make a play.
Jeff, what do you make of how unpredictable this series has been? Each team has lost two games in their own barn, and the Jets seem to be more comfortable right now at Bridgestone Arena.
Yeah, I always have like a little gut feeling before every game, what's going to happen, who's going to win. And I was going to go with Winnipeg as a big winner yesterday, but obviously that wasn't the case. And, you know, you think the home crowd and the whiteout, they're going to get all involved and they're going to dominate the Preds and finish the thing off. I talked to a coach in the NHL a couple of days ago, and he was already talking about the Winnipeg matchup against Vegas. So I guess both of us were a little too far ahead of ourselves. I think Nashville proved last night, though, that they've been through the wars and, you know, they got experience and they know how to deal with adversity. It's not easy to go into Winnipeg and win that game, and they did it. Had some guys make some fantastic plays.
Jeff, yesterday the Jets allowed a early goal to go down 1-0 about 62 seconds into the game, and then they have the opportunity to kind of take momentum back. They were given three power plays in the first, and they go 0-for-3, and they just couldn't set anything up. I mean, for a young team that's kind of figuring their way through the postseason, what does that do to the mentality of a young team as they progress through the rest of the game?
I think they're I think they're good enough and skilled enough to not let it phase them. Obviously, you'd like to see some kind of adjustment or find something that works. But, you know, guys like Mark Scheifele, Laine, all these guys, they're so skilled and so talented. I can't see it affecting their confidence. Maybe go over some video, see what the Preds did to prevent that, and then just go from there. But they're too skilled to have it happen two games in a row. And like you said about the predictability, I'm sure they're pretty comfortable going into Nashville for Game 7. They've done it before, and they had some fantastic offensive performances the last time in there, so they just got to feel good about themselves and try to be relaxed.
Jeff O'Neill's our guest on NHL this week. You know Jeff, of course, from TSN 1050 Overdrive in Toronto. Jeff, you mentioned the Jets having some great offensive performances thus far in this series in Nashville. The Predators have been so much better defensively on the road than they have been in their own arena. Is it harder to play a lockdown defensive style in front of your own fans? Is the tendency for players, skilled players like the Predators have, to try and push the pace more at home necessarily than on the road?
Well, I think sometimes you fall into the trap of you want to put a show at home, put a show on at home, and you know that's your main focus. But tomorrow is just about doing everything to get 2 points. It's not about a show. It's not about anything. It's about individuals stepping up and helping the team win. Obviously, you'd like your goaltender to be the one guy that's in lockdown mode. But tomorrow night is definitely not the opportunity. I said you got to have confidence to make a play. But you're not trying to put a show on. You're just doing whatever you can to win the game.
Now, Jeff, you mentioned the Vegas Golden Knights earlier. Whoever wins the series between the Jets and Preds, of course, is going to play the Golden Knights. They're going to also have home ice advantage. When you watch the Preds and they continue to amaze us game after game, is it just the speed? Is it that they're more talented than we think? Is it the goaltending? Is it the coaching? I mean, is it all of these things? What is it about the Golden Knights where we just can't seem to give them enough credit for how good they've been this year?
Well, you know, I talked to Pete DeBoer, and he said Marc-Andre Fleury is basically unbeatable right now. He let in one bad goal in 6 games. That's pretty impressive. And they just seem like they play the perfect team game. They're very fast. They're eliminating time and space. They get the pucks quick. They forecheck quick. They do everything quickly, and that's what the game is built on nowadays. And, you know, I don't know what they call themselves, the Vegas Misfits or whatever, but to assemble that hockey team in year one, what they're doing, sweeping L.A. and then beating San Jose in round two and off to the conference finals, it's pretty impressive. And I stopped counting them out. I said at the beginning of the year they're going to be the worst team in the league by far, along with the two guys I work with on our show, and then they win the division. Then they sweep the first round. They win the I'm tired of counting them out, so who's to say they won't go on and win the next round and go into a cup final in year one, which would be crazy.
Jeff, I'm just curious. There's so much talk about lineups and matchups and all that. What have you seen out of Scott Hartnell, and what does he provide for the Predators that he can get himself into a game and be effective this late in the year?
I think he's a guy that knows that he's on the last couple holes of the round as far as his career goes, and he understands that for him to be in the lineup and be effective, he's got to be a pain in the ass, and he's really good at doing that. He always has been. But he's one of those guys. He's a veteran presence. He's been through the wars before, and he's just one of those guys that seems to show up and get it done. He's, like I said, you know, he doesn't understand how many more opportunities he's going to get at this. Probably his last. I don't know what his career is going to look like after this year, but he's one of those guys that's playing with desperation. The old Mark Messier cliche, play every shift like it's your last, and it seems like he's doing that.
Jeff O'Neill, our guest on NHL this week. You know Jeff, of course, from TSN 1050 Overdrive in Toronto. Jeff, Alex Ovechkin finally, you know, defeats Sidney Crosby last night. The Capitals defeating the Penguins in overtime to win that series. Does this change the narrative of Ovechkin's career, or will only a Stanley Cup do that?
I think that, you know, regardless if this guy wins a Stanley Cup, he's going to go down as having a fantastic career, one of the greatest goal scorers ever. If you look at the goaltending his whole career, and he continues to put up goals. But I think ultimately if he wants to get rid of he wants to go to the World Championships and Russian performances and everything that he's dealt with, the Stanley Cup would be the topper on that. But I think the way he scored goals, I think his legacy is pretty much set in stone in the National Hockey League. It's awfully difficult to win, and although a big part about it has been about him in the past, it's about your team too. So, but the Cup would make it that much nicer for him.
Jeff, we wanted to ask you about Paul Maurice. You obviously played for Paul Maurice as a member of the Carolina Hurricanes, went all the way to the Stanley Cup final. What have you thought of the job that he's done here in the playoffs with a young team and some of the adjustments he's made against Minnesota and Nashville?
You know what? I'll go from the one experience I had at the Air Canada Center. I watched the Jets and Leafs live, and systematically, it was basically perfect hockey. So I think that you can have the talent, you can have all the players and the guys that can score goals, but I think he's got a great system there in place. I think he's grown a lot as a coach. And finally, he's been able to play or have a team underneath him that's really talented, and he has all the tools as opposed to, you know, poor teams in Winnipeg or poor teams in Carolina. Sometimes a good coach has got to have the general manager put a good group together, and I think he's done a fantastic job this year.
Jeff, I want to keep the focus out east. I'm just curious, what are your thoughts been on Tampa Bay Lightning forward Braden Point in the postseason he's been able to have thus far?
He has been fantastic. I watched that kid in the World Juniors, and I thought, I don't know if this guy can ever play. He's so small. But he is, I mean, John Cooper called him his best player in round two, and I totally agree. He had that matchup against the Bergeron line, and he was fantastic. He's one of those players, and you can tell why a guy like Steve Yzerman would appreciate it. Same right-handed shot, not that big, that does everything well on the ice. He's a terrific player. For so many years, it's been about Hedman, Stamkos, but he's a real key player for them, and I'm sure his responsibilities are continuing to grow as soon as as far as the Tampa Bay Lightning go, because he had a big assignment there with the Bergeron line. It only gets magnified now, probably Obi coming up.
Finally, Jeff, just one more for you. We were kind of discussing it before you came on here. What goes through your mind when you listen to a story about a gentleman who's eating 30,000 Big Macs?
I mean, I don't know how he's not dead. How do you eat that many? How do you even want? Like, I'm the kind of guy where I admit when I go to restaurants, I tend to order the same thing. But what happens with me is I get sick of it, and I just end up not even going to that restaurant, period. So how the hell do you continue to enjoy Big Macs like that is beyond me.
I guess everybody needs their own 15 minutes in the spotlight, and for some of us, it's by eating 30,000 Big Macs.
Yeah, he got it. He sure got it.
Jeff O'Neill's with TSN 1050 Overdrive in Toronto. O-Dog, always appreciate your time, buddy. Thanks for joining us.
All right, boys. Have a good night.
You too, Jeff. Thanks again. 30,000 cheeseburgers. Even you haven't. Big Macs, pardon me. 30,000 cheeseburgers are even conceivable.
That's like 60,000 patties.
I mean,
it kind of makes you wonder how many hamburgers you've eaten in your lifetime. How many hamburgers do you think you've eaten in your lifetime? I mean, I've definitely ate double whatever your number is.
I mean, I've probably had, I mean, I don't know. Let's do some simple math here. I'm 37. I'll be 37 years old. I probably didn't eat a hamburger in the first 7 years of my life.
Seven?
I don't know. Maybe five. Let's say 5 years. You know, until you really have, you start having a hamburger. So they take 32 hamburgers.
Hold on a second, Drew. This is maybe something you should be calculating when we're during break, as opposed to live on air, because this is probably going to take a couple minutes.
No, it's not. Let's say 32 years worth of hamburgers. Do I have, let's say, two hamburgers a month? So that's 24 hamburgers a year times 32 years. I mean, let's do some simple math here.
I think that's a little light.
It might be a little light. So that's 768 hamburgers. Let's round it up to 1,000.
That's way too low. Yeah. Way too low.
Let's say 1,000. Do you think I've had more than 1,000 hamburgers in my life?
Yes.
I think there's been periods in your life where you've eaten more than two hamburgers a month.
You think there's been some sad times?
No, I didn't say sad times.
Some really happy times.
I'm always happy when I'm eating burgers. Yeah. I'm not sad. Yeah, okay. I mean, sometimes you car eat and you get a little sad, but
yeah, at 4 a.m, you know, when you wake up hungry and you leave your house at 4 a.m. to do a ride drive-through run, it's a little sad.
Shawnee, I think I'd probably be pushing like 10,000 over my lifetime.
I'm trying to like do the math in my head. I used to work at McDonald's, so from 1999.
If you're talking about employee discounts,
so from the exactly 1999 to 2000. And I don't want to tally those numbers.
There were quite a few Junior McChickens
in
there.
It was 69-cent cheeseburger Sundays, and I got half off. So
and when you're a starving teenager, Shawnee, you're not a big boy, but you can probably pack some down if you're desperate enough.
I can put them back.
Attaboy. Okay, well, there you go. So apparently the answer is a lot of hamburgers for all of us. When we come back, we're going to talk about the Vegas Golden Knights. Their dream season continues with a series victory over the San Jose Sharks. They're off to the Western Conference Championships. We pay tribute to the Golden Knights up next. You're listening to NHL This Week. We're live on TSN Radio. 1290.
This is NHL Midweek,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
It's a foot race. Ryan Carpenter, the former Shark, sets a beacon. He hits
it. 3-0 Vegas. And the Vegas Golden Knights will check another box in their expansion season. They're on their way to the Western Conference Final. Marc-Andre Fleury with his fourth shutout of this postseason, 14th lifetime.
The dream season continues for the Vegas Golden Knights, and it very well might be a nightmare for the other 30 NHL teams, because at this point in time, there's no reason to say the Vegas Golden Knights aren't a legitimate Stanley Cup contender. I mean, they're in the Western Conference Finals. They beat the San Jose Sharks 4-2. They win that series. They've been sitting at home since, when was this game, last Sunday? They'll end up with almost an entire week off as game one of the Western Conference Finals.
Well, it's just like the first round.
Yeah, exactly. They had a week off.
Except I think they had 9 days off, if I'm not mistaken.
Sure, after sweeping the Kings. The Golden Knights game one of the Western Conference Finals, be it in Nashville or be it in Winnipeg, will be Saturday night at 6:00. So the Golden Knights will have been off for almost an entire week. And there's no reason to think that the dream season's going to come to an end anytime soon, because why not? I mean, seriously, at this point in time, why not? Welcome back to NHL This Week. You're listening to TSN 1290. This segment brought to you by Bernstein's Deli, official deli of Illegal Curve Hockey and home of the Illegal Curve Sandwich. Located in the Cordon Village Mall, Bernstein's Deli has been Winnipeg's deli destination for over 30 years. For more information, find them on Facebook or at bernsteinsdeli.com. Remember, if you're looking for a place to catch the game, maybe Thursday night's game per se, Bernstein's Deli's got you covered. They got big screen TVs. They've got the full volume on, so it's like you're there. They got great food and drink specials. It's hashtag Hockey Night at Bernstein's. I think the testament to the Vegas Golden Knights, even more so than the fact that they're in the Western Conference Finals now, is that during the series with San Jose, even when the series was tied at various points, at no point in time did I really think the Golden Knights weren't going to win the series. I mean, I thought that they were the better of the two teams, and I thought that they were going to, you know, it wouldn't have shocked me if San Jose had won Game 6, for example. But I wasn't surprised when Vegas won it, and I would have predicted Vegas to win in Game 7. I mean, they are just an incredible story, and I guess it shows you that speed, because, I mean, they have skill, but the speed that they have is what's just creating matchup problems up and down the lineup against a lot of other NHL teams.
Right, and the speed that they play with, Drew, is undeniable.
Yeah.
But this is just a good team now, and I agree with you. I mean, I think whoever wins the series between the Jets and Predators guys, they're probably going to be considered the favorite, just because these were the top two teams in the league and the Western Conference. But, I mean, if I'm analyzing whoever plays the Golden Knights that next series,
yeah,
I don't think that I'm expecting that series to go anything less than 6 games. I have no idea if it's going to go 7 games, but I wouldn't take the Jets or the Preds, Sean, in less than 6 games. And I think it's simply because this team, as you mentioned, continues to just really exceed expectations. And, you know, Jeff O'Neill touched on it. He picked the Golden Knights to be one of the bottom teams in the league. I think all of us predicted that they wouldn't be a playoff team. They've won the division. Now they're in the Western Conference Final. They're not going to have home ice advantage, which is going to hurt them. But, you know, watching this team, and I watched the Golden Knights more in the second round, Drew, than I did in the first round against the Kings. But the Sharks, I mean, they look slow at times, and it wasn't just one or two lines that was hurting the Sharks. And Marc-Andre Fleury, I mean, 4 shutouts in, what is it, 8 games?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, 10 games.
8 wins.
Pardon me, four shutouts in 10 games.
Yeah, and in 8 wins.
Exactly. And 8 wins, sorry, that's what I meant.
And 50% of your wins are coming from shutout. I mean,
it's incredible.
It's crazy.
And, you know, he's the best goalie so far after 2 rounds. And, you know, Pekka Rinne and Connor Hellebuyck are playing well as well. And you have to, you know, give a shout-out to Braden Holtby, who came in relieving Grubauer after Game 2 of the first-round series. But, I mean, this team can come at you in waves. And they play really well in 5-man units. And, you know, everyone knows their top line is really good. William Karlsson had a career year. You got Jonathan Marchessault and Riley Smith on the wings. But I really like that second line. You got David Perron, Eric Halla, and James Neal. You got Cody Eakin, good Winnipeg boy, centering that third line. And, you know, Nate Schmidt and Braden McNabb has actually been a really good shutdown pair for them. That second pair of Shea Theodore and Derek Englund has actually been really solid for them. And then you talked about it on Saturday's show, Drew, getting Lucas Abiza back after he suffered an injury and wasn't playing earlier in the playoffs and earlier in the season. He's been nice there as their third pairing defenseman, right? So they don't necessarily have that superstar power that the Jets have or the Lightning have or the Capitals have, but they play really well as a team and they're tough to play against. And they can score in waves. I mean, if you watch that series, it's not like the Vegas Golden Knights dominated every single game. I mean, they scored in bunches, and they were opportunistic, and the Sharks didn't really have an answer. And then you find out that Evander Kane was playing with all these injuries, and obviously Joe Thornton never came back. And
yeah.
But then you're just using that as an excuse. The reality is the Golden Knights deserve to win that series.
The depth of the Golden Knights has been tremendous. The puck pursuit and their tenacity to retrieve the puck when they don't have it has been impressive beyond belief. You feel silly doubting this team anymore. Anytime you think to yourself, there's no way they can do it, that little voice comes in and goes, no, well, they will do it because they've been doing it all season. And you talked about Marc-Andre Fleury, and we'll talk about our Conn Smythe candidates in the final segment, but I don't know how this guy is not the front runner in both closeout games. In both series, he's posted a shutout.
Let me ask you guys this. Obviously, Vegas gets full marks for what they've done so far. How advantageous has it been for them that they've played two series against teams not known for being offensively dynamic? I mean, you have the San Jose Sharks without Joe Thornton, which takes a huge piece of their offense out of the lineup. You have an LA Kings team that just notoriously can't score goals despite being a playoff team.
Well, and they were banged up. I mean, Jeff Carter was clearly not 100%. No, and the Kings just weren't very good this year.
Absolutely. I mean, they were a playoff team.
They were good enough to get in, but they weren't good enough to win a round.
Right. So how much does that... I mean, I don't want to take anything away from the Golden Knights, but they really haven't been tested. Their defense, which I think most people would say is their Achilles heel, because it's not a great defense on paper, at least. Nate Schmidt has been terrific this year, but it's not a great defense on paper.
It's not a great defense, but it's a pretty good group of defensemen.
They've been playing very well together, but they haven't really... My point is they haven't been overly tested against a offensively dynamic opponent yet.
Right.
In the playoffs. So they've played these first two rounds against two teams that, you know, were more low-scoring teams that relied on defense and structure. And, you know, and the Sharks being out without their best player in Joe Thornton, or at least a fantastic player, not their best player anymore as he's older, and Evander Kane, who was a good addition to their team, but he was banged up. I mean, I think it'll be very interesting to see the Golden Knights and the level of success that they have, and if they can be exposed at all, not to take any credit away from them, but if they can be exposed at all going up against a better offensive team like we see here in Winnipeg with the Jets or Nashville with the Predators, who can go with the, you know, they can get matchups to their advantage with, you know, with Johansson and with Arvidsson and with Forsberg and something like that. That'll be the real test for me, seeing the Golden Knights against a better offensive team than they've played so far.
Right, I would agree with that. I mean, I think the Jets and the Predators are better offensive teams than the Sharks and the Kings. I think we'd all agree with that. And the Jets are clearly a better offensive team than the Predators, just based on, I shouldn't say by a lot, but they have been the better offensive team in the series than they were during the regular season. Only Tampa scored more than the Jets during the regular season. So you're right, Drew. I mean, we're going to see how good they really are if they can get to the Stanley Cup final, because I think whoever emerges from this Jets-Predators series is going to be the favorite, but Vegas is not going to be an easy out because they haven't been all year.
They haven't been all year, and I don't want to take, again, I want to make perfectly clear, I'm not taking anything away from Vegas. They are going to be it's going to be a terrific Western Conference final. The scenes and the atmosphere.
Well, hopefully it is.
Well, I mean, I'd be surprised if it wasn't, is what I'm saying. The scenes in Vegas, the scenes in Nashville, the scenes in Winnipeg, wherever the finals are going to be, it's going to be a party. It's going to be a tremendous party, way more of a party than we're going to see out east with Tampa and Washington, which is, you know, that's going to be a good series, but it's not going to have the same drama attached to it as these three teams are going to have, two of these three teams are going to have with each other. I just think that Golden Knights are going to get a much stiffer test than they've seen so far in these playoffs.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And you talked about the depth at which the offensively that they'll have to face. And it'll be interesting to see maybe how they respond if Marc-Andre Fleury gets chased in a game, or, you know, they get lit up for six or whatnot. But this team has responded to the adversity that they've faced throughout the entire year. And I just quickly, we talk about like the speed and the pace at which they play. I don't know if you guys are watching that NHL Quest for the Stanley Cup that the league is releasing once a week. Anyways,
on YouTube.
Yeah, it's like those behind the scene things. Anyways, real quick, they went into the Knights dressing room, and literally every second or third word out of Gerard Gallant's mouth was pace, speed, or quickness. So just like they've just been hammering that message into these players, and they've been primed to play playoff hockey, and now they're in the Western Conference Finals awaiting the Jets or the Preds.
Well, I mean, George McPhee gets credit for putting a team together. At the same time, he also gets some slings and arrows for trading Marty Erat for Philip Forsberg. That's still the worst trade in the history of the NHL right now. We're certainly up there, maybe along the Joe Thornton trade and, well, Timu for Tavernovsky and Kilgar, as we all know all too well here in Winnipeg.
Great to see Timu last night signing autographs after the game. What an ovation that he got.
He doesn't age. It's crazy. I mean,
he does look like he can step onto the ice right now and probably score 30 goals.
Obviously, he lives the best life.
He hopped on a private jet and just came to the White Oak party.
I mean, he lives the best life. He lives in Southern California. I mean, what does he do all day? Golf,
tennis. I think he collects cars.
Yeah,
he races
tennis.
He races
loves
cars.
Federer.
Races cars. Yeah. Surf. Whatever you're going to do. I mean, it's a pretty good life. There's not a lot of stress in his life, and it looks like a guy who's living a pretty stress-free life. But it is always great to see Timu back in the barn. There's no question about that. Too bad that the Jets couldn't have a better performance for him. It all comes down to Game 7 Thursday night, the game you can hear, of course, live on TSN 1290. When we come back, Dan Duva, Vegas Golden Knights broadcaster, is going to join us, talk more about the Golden Knights as they're sitting, kicking up their heels. Maybe they're at rehab at Vegas. Maybe they're at one of the pool parties. I'm not sure.
Cosmo?
Maybe they're at the Cosmo. I don't know what they're doing.
I hope they're not at rehab, because it took me 4 days to recover from rehab.
Oh, you've been.
I've rehabbed.
Really? You've rehabbed? We might have to talk about that. I'm not cool enough to ever do that kind of thing, but Shawnee's got the cool factor that we
don't have. I don't know if I can recall what took place, to be honest. But
we'll get Shawnee some fireball shots during the break here.
There you go.
You have that?
Up next, you know, a little bit of Tiesto and Dan Duva as well. You're listening to NHL This Week. We're live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is NHL Midweek,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Hour number two of NHL This Week starts now on TSN 1290. Drew Mandel, Sean Assor, Ezra Ginsberg with you in studio. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and Manitoba Moose news and audio is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
Pleased to be joined now by our good friend. He's the Vegas Golden Knights play-by-play broadcaster. Dan Duva joins us on the line. Dan, good evening, and thanks very much for joining us.
Always a pleasure. Good to be with you.
So, Dan, now that the Golden Knights are through to the second round again and are going to have 6 days off between when they clinched on Sunday and when they start on Saturday, either in Nashville or here in Winnipeg, is Gerard Gallant just taking the same playbook that he took from the first, or the gap between the first and second round, and sort of using the same philosophy again?
Yeah, it's interesting because think about the previous layoff between rounds was 9 days,
mm-hmm.
and that was too long. And at the time, George Gallant said, you know, 5 days, maybe 6 days, that would be the sweet spot. Then you really have an opportunity to recover, and anybody who's banged up can truly get some fresh legs, that kind of stuff. Yeah, you also balance against the rust because there's that much time between games. And George McPhee was quick to point out that even though there was a 9-day break, it's not like it was a bye week and the team was going to Cabo for a few days. They were practicing and going through the motions. It was just a matter of how much time to spend on the ice, how much time to spend in the weight room, how much time to spend looking at video. And so I suppose the balance worked out well. Obviously, the Knights won 7-0 in their first game of round two. So if this is even better, 5 or 6 days between games, I think that Gerard Gallant's pretty happy with that. They did not skate yesterday, Monday, but they were back on the ice today. And I could tell you from personal experience, there was not a single parking spot to be found outside City National Arena. That's how packed it was. Just fans going to watch practice.
Dan, Sean brought this up last segment. Are the Golden Knights at all concerned that they haven't dealt with enough adversity in these playoffs? Have the Golden Knights talked about the lack of adversity that they've dealt with? Is that something that they should be concerned about, in your opinion, or is that something they shouldn't be concerned about just because they've been playing so well here in the first two rounds?
Yeah, I wonder if the adversity doesn't come across as much as it might have, perhaps the Knights were in a game seven on the road or that kind of a thing. Even though they swept the Kings, each of those games was a one-goal game. There was a lot of intensity there, and even in game three, sure the Knights had won the first two at home, but they're losing 2-0 in the third period of game three. And you're like, okay, well, the home team is supposed to win X, Y, Z. But then they go and score three goals and win game three, 3-2. And so they had a 3-0 series lead, and then, of course, they clinched it in four games. And even that was a one-goal game. Then you go on to take on the Sharks, and remember, the Sharks had swept too. And remember that until the Knights clinched the series in game six, just like Winnipeg and Nashville, every other team had won one game. Nobody won two in a row until the Knights won games five and game six. So it might not seem as though there was a ton of adversity. I understand that. But if having been around it in the moment, there was more adversity than probably meets the eye. Remember, they got shut out 4-0 in game four. So that doesn't happen very often, especially at T-Mobile Arena. So I think that there are things that you could look at and say adversity hasn't been faced as much as some other teams in the postseason. But you look at the big picture and all the adversity that the organization has faced throughout the year. Of course, Marc-Andre Fleury being out for 2 months, they stayed afloat with all of that. Other injuries down the stretch, they've managed to get pretty healthy here. And I think that that's as much as anything a reason why that they've gotten to this point.
Dan, I want to ask you about Marc-Andre Fleury. The guy's got two shutouts in closeout games this postseason. I believe it's three if you date back to a previous postseason. But what does that do for a team? Just what kind of profound level of confidence does that provide them going into those big games?
Yeah, it's a couple of things. First off, the team's played very well in season. And with a couple of exceptions, there has been a great effort to support Fleury's crease. You know, the Sharks managed to attack from the side of the net, a couple of pick plays, and that led to some scramble goals. But the Sharks had a hard time 5-on-5. And a good chunk of that is the players in the defensive zone provide a limitation on secondary chances. And Fleury has been the beneficiary of that. But the team has the benefit of Fleury's personality. And you see it a little bit on TV, more so in person, and even more when you're in the locker room and you see how he interacts with his teammates. But he just relaxes everybody because of his smile. He's got a joke. You know, you see him caressing the pipe after a puck hits the iron instead of going in. When they do the wave, like, and it's the puck and the play is not in his end, like, he'll raise his arms kind of as if he's doing the wave. And, you know, there's just all those little things that, and I think that in a tense moment for a guy who's been through it all and his name on three cups, his personality rubs off on the rest of the group. And I think that, as much as his goaltending, could probably be his biggest contribution to this team.
Dan Duva's our guest on NHL this week. Dan's the play-by-play broadcaster for the Vegas Golden Knights. Golden Knights sitting pretty in Vegas waiting for the winner of the Predators-Jets series for the Western Conference Final, which will start on Saturday night. Dan, you know, the Golden Knights certainly deserve full marks for their performance, but they've played two teams that you would not describe as offensive juggernauts in the Kings and the Sharks in the first two rounds. How do you think the series will change or their style will change having to play against more offensively dynamic teams in either the Jets or the Predators?
Yeah, and the Sharks, different than the Kings. Los Angeles was just a terrific shutdown defensive team. And, think about it. The Knights scored a grand total of 7 goals, and the Kings scored a grand total of 3 in a 4-game series. That really says something. And that was the story for the Kings through the year. The Sharks were different in that they played a higher tempo. You knew there were going to be more goals in the series, and could the Knights break out offensively? And the answer was yes. And then they found out a couple of different times how they could shut down that Sharks offense. It took some tinkering for Pete DeBoer, but they did shut out the Knights 4-0. in that one game. So I think that when you see Winnipeg and Nashville as potential opponents, I'm not sure that the Golden Knights changed their game. They have been so successful at playing their brand of hockey and trying to dictate it as much as they can. It's a fast team, and fast not only in terms of skill, like breakaways, but also fast in recovering pucks, fast in creating physical play, moving the puck for the handful of guys that are not fast skaters. That has been their great asset. Now, could it be a little bit different against Winnipeg or Nashville because of the, I mean, especially Winnipeg, because Winnipeg's not just fast. Winnipeg's big and fast. The Knights aren't very big, but they have a couple of guys that might be able to negate that size advantage. You know, Ryan Reeves made his postseason debut with the Knights in the last game. I thought played very well. Lucas Pisa had not played since February, and he's a stronger defenseman than, say, John Merrill or Brad Hunt, who had been in there in the last 2 months. So I think that there is enough balance on this team that the Knights could handle either the Jets or the Predators. Not to say they would win, but I think that the way that they are made up allows them to play different kinds of hockey while still maintaining their identity. But I can tell you that, to me, that the, even though the Knights won the Pacific Division, just watching the Nashville-Winnipeg series, I think that most people would agree that those are the top two teams in the Western Conference. But the best teams don't always win. So I look forward to watching Game 7 and then diagramming it up, see how the matchups work out. It'll be a lot of fun no matter who moves on.
Dan, I don't want to go negative here because the Vegas Golden Knights have been such a great story all year long. But in your opinion, why hasn't it worked out for Thomas Tatar? He's been a healthy scratch for the majority of the playoffs, and the Golden Knights did give up 3 draft picks to acquire Tatar from the Wings.
Yeah, and if anything, and you're absolutely right. It just hasn't clicked for him. And you see who they gave up. And I think it's sort of a credit to the organization, whether it's George McPhee or Gerard Gallant, even knowing what they gave up to get him, that they don't feel compelled to put him in the lineup for that reason. If he's not giving them the best chance to win, you know, just because of the price tag, he doesn't have to play. And he was in there, especially at the start of the playoffs, because David Perron was still unavailable. Well, Perron comes back, and then you're looking at, okay, who might get squeezed out here? It frankly just hasn't clicked. You know, I've seen Tomas Tatar since he was in the American League. He won the Butterfield Trophy. He is the Calder Cup Playoffs MVP with Grand Rapids in 2013. I was on the other side with Syracuse that year, so I saw him perform in the clutch deep into the Calder Cup Playoffs. But for whatever reason, and maybe it's the type of hockey that he's accustomed to in Detroit doesn't quite jive with how the Golden Knights have been playing. Detroit was the only organization he was ever a part of until now. He's a heck of a nice guy. Nobody wants to succeed more than he does. He's as hardworking and as friendly a guy as you'll ever see in the locker room. But maybe that means he grips his stick a little too much. Maybe he's a little bit too eager to please. And while we've seen so much chemistry with the top few lines for the Knights, even the fourth line has had chemistry. It just didn't quite click. And you see that as a power play performer, as he was in Detroit, if he can't get on the power play or the top two lines with the Golden Knights, then he might not be able to deliver in a non-power play role and maybe a third line role. At this stage of the year, you just don't have too much of a leash to experiment with somebody who hasn't really hit his stride with this organization.
Dan, last one for you here. How underrated is Riley Smith?
Oh, yeah. I've often described him as the glue to the top line, and when he was unavailable for about a month to close out the season, I think it was evident not only in the production of Carlson and Marchessault, but it's not just the production, it's the defensive zone play. I mean, he's on a penalty kill with William Carlson almost always. And they're so responsible in the defensive zone. I mean, even the game-winning goal that Carlson had a few games back, it was Jonathan Marchessault had blocked the puck in his own zone, and it led to a breakout. But Riley Smith is someone that has produced in the postseason. George McPhee told me that when he watched the Florida Panthers play against the New York Islanders a couple of years ago, when Turk was the coach and George was advising the Islanders, he said the best player for the Panthers in that series was Riley Smith. And he has put up basically a point per game, but obviously the shutout loss an exception. But it's a lot more than just the points. He's just an all-around solid player. He's got a subtle sense of humor. And I, like I say, I think he's the glue. He binds a lot of that, what that top line does together.
Dan Duva is the Vegas Golden Knights play-by-play broadcaster. Dan, appreciate your time this evening. Hopefully we'll see you here in Winnipeg on Saturday. If that is the case, though, if you could do us a favor and leave Lawless back in Vegas, that'd be great.
Yeah, I don't think I'll be able to accomplish that, but I'll see what I can do.
Thanks, Dan. Enjoy the ride wherever, if it takes you here or takes you to Nashville.
Great. Thanks so much, guys.
Take care, Dan. When we come back, we talk about the Washington Capitals. They slayed the dragon named Crosby. Ovechkin off to the Eastern Conference Championship. That's up next. You're listening to NHL This Week. We're live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is NHL Midweek,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
From a meeting with Tampa Bay in the conference final, it is Ovechkin moving back.
Evgeny Kuznetsov with the Game 6 overtime winner. The Washington Capitals advance to the Eastern Conference Championship. They'll play the Tampa Bay Lightning. The Pittsburgh Penguins go home. We will have a new Stanley Cup champion this year. Welcome back to NHL This Week. This segment of the show brought to you by our good friends at Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, officially declared the funniest place in Winnipeg by Illegal Curve Hockey. For over 30 years, Rumors has been bringing Winnipeg the best in stand-up comedy. To purchase tickets or for a list of performers and showtimes, visit RumorsComedyClub.com. Winnipeg's favorite, Mark Forward, in town at Rumors all this week. The fun starts in about, 25 minutes from now. So be sure to get your tickets to check out Mark Forward at Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club all week long. Tickets are going to go fast as he's certainly one of Rumors' more popular comedians who comes to town. And remember, any time a playoff game goes to overtime, that means it's time for the hashtag I-C-O-T pool.
Can you say that any slower?
Probably. Anyways, anytime a game goes to overtime, use the hashtag ICOTPool. Send us the name of the player you think is going to score. If you're correct, you may win a prize to Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club. So anytime a game goes to overtime, keep it tuned to our Twitter feed, at Illegal Curve, for all the information you need.
By the way, is Mark Forward's cousin going to be performing at Rumors as well, Kevin Reverse?
I mean, you had to see that coming from a mile away, Sean. Like, you had to see that coming. I mean, as soon as you got that little grin on your face that you always get on your face when the monkey in your head is beginning to churn and you think, I got a funny here. And that's what happens as you go with Kevin Reverse. I'll tell you who's going forward. That's the Washington Capitals as they go forward and drive over the Pittsburgh Penguins. Finally defeating the Pittsburgh Penguins in a playoff series.
What an overtime goal by Evgeny Kuznetsov.
Beautiful goal. Just a gorgeous goal. I mean,
and he's been good all playoffs long.
Yeah, the best players for the Capitals have been their best players, which is so rare for them.
What about the fact, Drew, that they didn't have Nicklas Backstrom in the lineup? I realize that Ovechkin and Kuznetsov play together, and then Backstrom centers that second line because that's what Barry Trotz did. But no, it's an absolutely great story. And, you know, Barry Trotz and Ovechkin are both going to the conference final for the first time ever. I mean, people forget Trotz never took the Predators to the conference final. It was Peter Laviolette that took the Predators to the conference final for the first time. So just an amazing story. We were talking about it before the playoffs started, Shawnee, that, you know, Barry Trotz really had to take this team far because he's in the last year of his contract. Mm-hmm. And I think, quite frankly, he out-coached Mike Sullivan in this series.
I would think so. I mean, I thought the adjustments he made were more significant than Mike Sullivan's adjustments. The Penguins finally looked like they hit a wall in this series. I mean, they were
flat for much of the series.
They were flat for much of the playoffs. I mean, you thought that when they acquired Derek Brassard at the trade deadline, it was going to give him a boost. Phil Kessel was pretty lousy these playoffs. I mean, Crosby and Gensel.
Did Brassard even score a goal?
I think he had one goal and maybe two assists in the postseason.
One goal, three assists.
Three assists. He was awful. I mean, that proved to be a terrible trade.
That was a bad hockey pool pick.
Yeah, it was surprising. Did you draft him?
Yeah, but yeah. I took Gensel, though, so that was pretty good.
That was a little bit better.
Nice.
But, I mean, Broussard was awful. You thought that he really was a missing piece that they missed out when Nick Bonino, left to go to Nashville in this offseason, and you thought Broussard would come in there, and then all of a sudden they go Crosby, Malkin, Broussard up the middle, and then Riley Sheahan as your fourth-line center. The Penguins were off all season long. And, again, you can't three-peat. It's impossible to do. You're not going to see it anymore in the NHL, just because the wear and tear on your body just doesn't. It's hard enough to do it 2 years in a row.
Exactly.
That 3 years in a row is just a non-starter, and the Penguins, you know, I think get full credit for getting this far, and you tip your hat to them and you say enjoy the rest of your offseason. They'll have to do a little bit of retooling. You know, they might need to get some bit more speed and maybe some more talent on their bottom six. On their back end.
Yep.
But this Penguins team isn't going anywhere.
Yeah, and I actually thought Jamie Oleksiak did a pretty good job. He scored a goal in this series, but I mean, Jamie Oleksiak is a third pairing defenseman.
Yeah,
I think it's more so, you know, shoring up that top four. Even though I really like Brian Dumoulin. I've told you that several times over the years, Drew.
Mm-hmm.
I like Dumoulin. He's not going to be a guy that scores very much, but he's a good solid defensive defenseman. And hey, look it, guys, we're going to be dissecting the Pittsburgh Penguins here for the much of, you know, the spring and summer. But the reality is, I mean, the Capitals were better. And not only that, there were 3 out of the 6 games of this series that were one goal games.
Yeah.
Right.
And those are the games the Capitals usually lose. Mm-hmm. I mean, history is the Capitals lose game 6 in Pittsburgh. They lose that overtime game. And then they go into Washington at home and they lay an egg. And this year, the Capitals were able to, flip the script and take advantage of what I'm going to call a wounded Pittsburgh Penguins team, a Penguins team that wasn't as good as the past 2 years, obviously, and good for the Penguins to get to the conference finals. Can they beat the Lightning, though?
Well, it's a good question, and, you know, the Lightning, we know they're the best offensive team in the league, and they really got better as that series against the Bruins progressed, Shawnee, but,
lost game one, won the last 4.
Exactly, and, you know, back to the injuries, too. I mean, didn't have Andrei Burakovsky in this series, and they didn't have Tom Wilson, who was suspended for the last 3 games of this series, right? So you don't have Nicholas Backstrom, you don't have Wilson, and you don't have Burakovsky in this series, and you still win. Pardon me, in this game.
Right.
And Wilson wasn't there for the last 3 games, so half of the series they didn't have Wilson, who was on the top line with Kuznetsov and Ovechkin. So, I mean, give Barry Trotz and his coaching staff a lot of credit that they were able to still win this series with some key bodies out. But Tampa's going to be a tough test for the Capitals. But, you know, this is a team that we know isn't playing with as much pressure as they have the last couple of years when they won the President's Trophy. And I think it really comes down to depth scoring. I really think that, you know, Crosby, Gensel, and Hornquist were excellent. But that depth scoring that they had in the previous years, you mentioned Nick Bonino, Phil Kessel. What did Phil Kessel have, 1 goal in 12 games or whatever it was?
He was invisible these playoffs.
Right, and, you know, sure, he might be dealing with some injuries here, Shawnee, and I'm not coming down on Phil Kessel. Kessel's a great player, great scorer. I'm just saying he wasn't the same Phil Kessel that we've been used to, and, you know, maybe fatigue played a factor here. Penguins have played a lot of hockey over the last 3 years.
It's hard to overly criticize anyone on the Penguins for not succeeding in three-peating.
Exactly.
I mean, it's
not like they missed the playoffs.
No.
I mean, they lost to a pretty good Capitals team.
Yeah, what are we really talking about? So they didn't win the second-round playoff matchup after going back-to-back Stanley Cup champions. It's hard to be a Penguins fan and really be ripping your hair out over the performance of this team.
I think what we're overlooking is that if you need to slay a dragon, if you need to beat a team that you cannot get through over years and years and years of experience, just add some Australian flavor to your team.
Oh, it's clearly what it is.
Nathan Walker gets into the lineup, and the Aussie makes things happen.
Yeah, I mean, you obviously every NHL team needs more of an Australian flavor. He got an assist, obviously, in the game that he played. You know, going back to the Lightning and the Capitals for the Eastern Conference Final, the Lightning have been just dominant in the first 2 rounds that they've played.
Not only that, Drew, since the beginning of the season.
Sure, but everyone forgot about them because they were so dominant for so long, and then they coasted for the last 30 games of the year, and maybe they didn't play as well over those last 30 games. But, you know, remember the Bruins and the Lightning, who came right down to the last game of the regular season as to who was going to have home ice advantage in that series. I mean, the Lightning took the Bruins and said, "You're not in our class." And that's pretty impressive because the Boston Bruins are a pretty good hockey team.
Is it the Tampa Bay Lightning or the Tampa Bay Rangers?
Well, I mean, yes, they certainly have a lot of New York Ranger influence.
No, but honestly, I mean, like, Ryan McDonagh, was he not the perfect trade deadline acquisition. He was great in the series against the Bruins. That's exactly what they needed.
Yeah. The Lightning right now look like the best team in the NHL.
The depth is madness.
And, I mean, this is Braden Point's coming out party.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, right now, if you're betting against the Lightning against the Capitals, I'm not sure what you're seeing.
I honestly don't know how more people aren't talking about Braden Point. He finished second in the fastest skater competition to Connor McDavid at the All-Star game. He was great last year in his rookie year.
Mm-hmm.
This is his second year in the league. He was one of the top players in the WHL for the Moose Jaw Warriors.
10 points,
and it seems
10
like
games.
Enough people are still not knowing how good he is. It's incredible. Well, he's a great center.
Sorry to interrupt you, Ezzy, but what's really interesting is you talk about the points and the speed, but his mental wherewithal, he had a terrible game one. He was a -5 mm-hmm. during game one versus the Bruins, and then just flipped the switch and was by far the Lightning's best player for the remainder of that series. So just the, the intestinal fortitude of a young up-and-coming player, he's something to watch.
Attaboy there, Macho Man. When we come back, Joe Smith.
We'll snap it to a Slim Jim.
You probably have a Slim Jim after the burger conversation.
Naomi actually made me dinner and I haven't eaten any of it, so.
Yeah, well, it's really good of you to not be eating a sandwich while on air.
By the way, how are your rolled gold pretzels over there, Drew?
I'm enjoying some pretzels
and, your Fresca.
And a Fresca. It's like I'm a 75-year-old grandfather with this afternoon snack.
Where are your Werther's butterscotch candies?
Dinner's at 4:30.
They're in my pocket. They're in my pocket, let me tell you. And there's no wrapper on those. I'm going to hand you
half
one.
Eaten,
there's no wrapper on that thing, and it's been there for a while.
When we black licorice, too.
Yeah, when we come back, Joe Smith of TheAthletic.com is going to join us, talk more about the Tampa Bay Lightning. You're listening to NHL This Week. We are live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is NHL Midweek,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Bottom of the hour. Welcome back to NHL This Week. We're live here on TSN 1290. This segment brought to you by our good friends Frank and Mauro Zappia of Zappia Group Realty, official realtors of Illegal Curve Hockey. When 95% of your clients come via referral, it shows your commitment to honesty, integrity, and a total dedication to client satisfaction. For all your real estate needs, come shake hands with Frank and Mauro Zappia online at zappiagroup.com. Tampa Bay Lightning trying to get a hold of Joe Smith, hoping he's going to be able to join us this segment. Can you turn down your computer volume yet again, Mr. Ginsburg, or at least tell us what the hotels.com ad was talking about?
Sorry about that.
It's only an every single show occurrence.
You have to not let that phase you and just keep going on instead of throwing me right under the bus.
No, I have to throw you.
Or
right
in my case, the van.
The minivan. Yeah. If you see somebody rolling around town with a minivan and a baby on board sticker, that's Mr. Ginsburg here. Be sure to hoot and holler at him.
Well, no, Naomi drives the van. I drive the car.
You drive the car. Okay. Yep. Well, but now when you and Naomi go somewhere together.
Nao drives.
Nao drives the van. So you're not allowed to drive the van is basically what it boils down to?
Well, I was allowed to drive the van around the parking lot the other day, but aside from that, like, I don't get to go on the big streets.
You don't know? She doesn't trust you to make the complicated left-hand turns
maybe
or anything?
Maybe, like, side streets in River Heights, but, like, the major thoroughfares, no.
Have you
that's a no-go.
Have you parallel parked the van?
I have.
And how'd that
I
work?
Actually did pretty well.
Yeah, okay.
We talking bench seats or pilot seats?
Oh, bench seats or pilot seats? Quickly.
We have bucket seats.
Ooh,
yep.
Bucket seats.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We're pleased to welcome back to the program Joe Smith. Joe covers the Tampa Bay Lightning for TheAthletic.com in Tampa. Joe, good evening, and thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, how are you?
Doing well, Joe. How about yourself?
Good.
That's good. Lightning obviously advanced to the Eastern Conference Final with a 4-1 series victory over the Boston Bruins. And, you know, they lost game one handily, and then they swept the next four from the Bruins. Are you surprised with, maybe ease isn't the right word, but the ease that they dispatched the Boston Bruins in this series?
Well, I mean, I thought it'd be a 6- or 7-game series, and, the way the regular season went and how much they kind of, even as John Cooper called it, manhandled and waxed them in the season, he thought this would be a dogfight. And I don't think any of us thought that the Lightning would win 4 straight games, including 2 in Boston, where they've only had won 8 times in 53 regular season meetings up to that point. So, but I think what happened and what you saw in that series, is the, it was a better team won, the deeper team, the faster team, and Lightning found its way to peak at the right time. They had some struggles in maybe February and March, but they really, you know, found that engaged, edge, emotional type play, and all their pieces started to work together in a very deep four-line, three-pairing unit. Has them feeling in a pretty good fit. Pretty good spot going into Friday's opener.
Joe, is it possible that Brad Marchand licking Ryan Callahan galvanized the Lightning and it propelled them to win the series in five?
I don't know about that. I mean, it definitely annoyed him, definitely ticked him off. But I think the series was going in the Lightning's favor even before Marchand decided to do that. You know, you saw it, you know, in Game 3. You saw it in Game 4. You know, they even strike gold. Boston didn't have an even strike gold the final three games of the series. The Lightning was just a deeper team with the bottom six. And obviously that didn't play well in the Lightning locker room, but, you know, the scoreboard was the one that hurt the most, I think, is Stamkos that big goal to tie the game, and then they won overtime with Dan Quattardi's goal. So it's a team that doesn't get rattled very often. They're a very experienced group that's been there and done that, and I think that's what showed in the series.
Joe, you talk about not getting rattled. I want to focus on Braden Point and how he was able to recover from a -5 game one into arguably being one of the top players on the Lightning moving forward.
Yeah, I mean, he. If you ever, you know, met him or been around him a lot, or if you coached him, you know, he's a very soft-spoken and kind of shy on the outside, but he's just has a crazy competitive fire on the inside, and he's a very determined player, and after that game, that first one, he wasn't a minus five that was all on him. I don't think the coaches found a really cause scoring chance on his part. He just happened to be on the wrong end of those goals. So when he was a -6 going into the second goal of game two, he was a +8 after that. He just really turned it on, and he played his sound two-way game. He was responsible. He was defending. He used that speed that's been gone from average to elite. I wrote about that in The Athletic for tomorrow. About his transformation in that respect. So, you know, he's a guy that is one of the, arguably the best player on the Lightning team for a lot of the year, a lot of games during the season, the heartbeat, the engine, and he proved that in being the best player in that series, I thought.
Joe Smith is our guest on NHL This Week. We're discussing the Tampa Bay Lightning. Joe covers the team for TheAthletic.com. Joe, you know, Ryan McDonagh sort of got the headlines when he was acquired from the New York Rangers, but JT Miller has certainly been just as important, you know, as McDonagh. He's been very important, at least, as McDonagh has for the Lightning. You know, what about the contributions of Miller? What does Miller bring to the Lightning that sort of solidifies that top six or that top nine of the team?
Well, he brings an element that they haven't really had for a number of years they've been looking for. I mean, they've got a bunch of very skilled, very fast forwards that are maybe on the smaller side. They didn't really have that kind of power forward guy with some grit, you know, some great hands around the net. I think Alex Horn's one of those guys too, but a guy who could really drive to those dirty areas and be able to complement players like Stamkos and Kucherov. And, you know, when the trade happened, I don't think anybody expected him to lead the team in goals from the trade deadline to the end of the regular season. He had 10 in the last 19 games, but you could tell in a given a bigger opportunity than he got in New York, he's kind of, you know, yanked around from the fourth line to the first line. He got a regular opportunity in the top six, and he showed that he could play with those top players, and, you know, had that go, you know, great game tying assist in the Stamkos goal in game four. The goal had power play goal in game five with the play that him and Kucherov drew up on their own before the playoffs started, and kind of a give and go to set that up. So, I mean, he's brought another element that they didn't have before in that size, and he'll need that against the Washington Capitals as well.
Joe, the Lightning just found out who they're going to play in the Eastern Conference Final last night, obviously, with Washington slaying the Dragon, beating the Detroit Red Wings. Pardon me, the Detroit Red Wings.
Red Wings.
The Pittsburgh Penguins. When you look at this matchup between the Lightning and the Capitals, what is a key matchup for you? Is there one key matchup that stands out? Is it going to be which D-pair is matched up against the Kuznetsov-Ovechkin line, or is there maybe another matchup that you're going to have your eye on in this series?
Well, I think you'll clearly be able to see the, you know, the point line and the McDonough-Strawman go up against Ovechkin's line. There's no question about that. I think the biggest thing for me is with how good the Lightning is 5-on-5 and how good defensively they are, I think the key is them you know, not giving the Capitals too many power plays. I know special teams seem like a cliche of saying it's important in every game, and it is, but especially you saw in the Boston series where the Lightning controlled that series 5-on-5, but they gave Boston so many power plays that Boston, you know, easily could have been that, could have been a 2-2 series after game four, had it not been for that tying goal by Stamkos. So if you give Washington, which has a 36% power play percentage, the playoffs, a chance to get 4 or 5 tries a night, like, you're going to be in trouble. So I think the matchups on regular even strength will be important. The point versus Ovechkin line, seeing who on the Capitals can defend the Stamkos Kucherov line. But, you know, it'll come down to, in my opinion, you know, the bottom six. Who are the depth players that step up and carry this team? And I think the Lightning showed in that last series that they had the third and fourth lines to really contribute. And the Capitals, I think, can too, with more than just Ovechkin and Kuznetsov pairing.
Joe, I want to ask you about Andre Palat. You know, he had those two quick goals in, I believe it was game three, but just watching this guy and the way he operates on the ice, he is a physical specimen who really likes to throw the body around.
He is. And I always call him kind of the engine of every line he's on. He was in the triplets line back in 14-15, and he didn't have the notoriety of the Johnson or Kucherov, but he makes all the little plays that don't show up in the score sheet that make a huge difference. You know, coming out of the forecheck and getting a loose puck, or going to the corner and winning a battle, or blocking a shot defensively, or taking a hit to make a play, and those things don't go unnoticed by his teammates and his coaching staff. And, you know, he got rewarded in that game with two quick goals by going to the net, and then one going to the net as well, getting a pass and scoring. So, you know, a lot of talented, a lot of high caliber, a lot of, you know, big name guys on this team, but the guys like him and the Gourds and the Sorellis are really kind of what makes them stick.
Joe, Steven Stamkos scored a couple of goals in the series against the Bruins. He scored one goal in the first round series against the Devils. Is that a good thing for the Lightning that they were able to get to the Eastern Conference Final and Stammer only has three goals, or is that a sign to maybe be concerned about that?
I think it's a good sign that, you know, that takes for a few games in each one of the two series that you didn't have a dominant Kucherov, a dominant Stamkos. They came and they stepped up when they needed them the most, but, you know, they showed that how much depth. This is the deepest team that I've covered in Tampa Bay, even deeper than the teams of 14-15 and the team 15-16. Having Sorelli brought to that the third line, second last half, the last month of the season, really gave them a chance to move Johnson up to the second line and kind of really deepen and thicken their lineup to where you put the third D pair up against that third line, you could be in trouble. So, you know that those goals are going to come from Stamkos. You know the Kucherov's going to end up taking over a game. But to have them not having to be the X factor every one of those games and knowing other guys can step up and play that way has to be encouraging if you're a Lightning fan going into the conference final against an even better, determined team in the Washington Capitals.
Last question for you, Joe, and it's sort of on a similar vein to the previous one. Victor Hedman went through the entire series against the Devils without getting on the score sheet. He had 6 points in the 5 games against the Bruins. Do you sense that his game is picking up as the series get more important and as the playoffs get closer and closer to, you know, the finals and then the Stanley Cup finals?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think he played poorly in the first round. He just wasn't as active offensively or wasn't as productive offensively. He's their best defenseman. He's their horse, and he plays in all situations, and he's going to be on the ice in a lot of important minutes. So I just think that he got a little more active in the second series or in Boston series because he was more aggressive, and having Ryan McDonough playing a lion's share of the minutes against the Bergeron line freed him a little bit to go up in the rush and make some plays. So I don't think they're worried at all about, you know, Hedman racking up a lot of points. They know that his biggest influence, you know, will be also filling the rush, but also playing in his own end, where they have a lot of very talented and powerful players up front in Washington.
Joe Smith covers the Tampa Bay Lightning for TheAthletic.com in Tampa Bay. Joe, appreciate your time this evening. Thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, no problem, guys. Anytime. Take care.
Take care, Joe. When we come back, we look at the early Conn Smythe rankings. You're almost 2 full rounds complete. 2 full rounds, less 1 game, of course. And we'll talk about who's the leader in the clubhouse for the Conn Smythe. You're listening to NHL This Week. We're live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is NHL Midweek,
the podcast,
on TSN1290.ca.
Point Watson gets it. He toe drags. Shoots. Oh, unbelievable. Right at point.
Nowitzki in back of the goal. He'll dance in front. Oh, Fleury! My goodness! What a stop on Logan Couture.
Coming up with it is Backstrom, moving out with Ovechkin in a two-on-one. Backstrom moving on. Across to Ovechkin. He scores! With 107 to go! Stabs needle line across the ice. Score! Buffalo!
The quick release of Dustin Byfuglien. No backswing, just a quick hard wrister, and there's a celebration for this crowd to get excited about.
Props to producer Rory putting together that montage of Conn Smythe contenders.
Rory Mac.
Rory Mac, as we are two playoff series complete, less one game seven on Thursday night between the Jets and the Predators. So it's certainly not too early to look at who you guys would have as your front runners, as even your leader in the clubhouse for the Conn Smythe Trophy, as we're almost halfway through the marathon that is the NHL playoffs. Mr. Ginsburg?
Yeah, for me, three players stand out right now. What I find fascinating, Shawnee, about the Conn Smythe race right now is that the top five playoff scorers right now are all out. Right, so you're talking about Jake Gensel, Sidney Crosby, David Pastrnak, Brad Marchand, and Patrice Bergeron. For me, the three guys that stand out right now that have to be in the lead are Alex Ovechkin, Marc-Andre Fleury, and I'm going to say Big Buff. And I realize that Mark Scheifele's in the conversation as well with 9 goals and 14 points in 11 games, but for me, Buff has been dominant physically. He's been great at both ends of the ice. He's scored some key goals. He's had some key assists in the first two rounds against the Wild and against the Predators. But, I mean, Alex Ovechkin right now, I mean, what more can you say? He finally defeats his nemesis, Sidney Crosby. Mm-hmm. He was great in the first round against Columbus because, you remember, Columbus went up 2-0 in that series, and it looked like the Capitals might be one and done.
Sure.
But they won the next four games. Braden Holtby has been fantastic. We'll see what happens here in the next round, Sean. I mean, if the Capitals are able to beat the Lightning, there's a good chance that Braden Holtby outplays Andrei Vasilevsky. Holtby's been great, but for me, it's Ovechkin, it's Marc-Andre Fleury, and it's Dustin Byfuglien, and I'd probably give the edge right now actually to Ovechkin.
Over Fleury?
Probably, yeah.
Oh, okay, I'm a little surprised about that, but I appreciate. And obviously, you know, had Pittsburgh been able to beat the Capitals, Gensel and Crosby mm-hmm. would be in this conversation, but by virtue of the fact that they got knocked out in six games in the second round, that obviously when their Conn Smythe chances went away. Sean, you have any differings from Mr. Ginsburg over there?
I think just my front runner, if we're going to stick to this clubhouse analogy, is Marc-Andre Fleury. Just what he's been able to do, the stability he's been able to provide, the shutouts in series clinching games, and just the level of calm he's been able to bring to the team. It was a great story when he was injured at the beginning of the year and they had the Karras wheel of players coming into the net, but I really think that if Marc-Andre Fleury wasn't in the pipes right now, Vegas would just be... She'd be handing in her, what is it, a glass slipper? Cinderella?
Yes, that would be Cinderella.
What's that story? Glass, yeah. That crazy story?
That's fine. a fable of Cinderella, you're right, a fairy tale, as I believe what the technical term is. It's sort of funny that we're talking about all these Conn Smythe teams, and you look at the top five scorers in the playoffs so far, and all of them are on teams that have been eliminated from playoff contention, which just goes to show you, Gensel and Crosby, we know how dominant they were for the Penguins, and then they had nothing in terms of secondary scoring. And then you look at the Bruins with Pastrnak, Marchand, and Bergeron, and just how dominant they were, and then they had nothing in terms of secondary scoring. So it shows you that you can't be a one-trick pony, you can't be a one-line team to really make a lengthy run in the playoffs, and that's what you're seeing, from all these teams, is that they're getting success from unlikely sources, third, fourth line players.
Yeah, and another player, Drew, that I'd throw
both
in there.
Both of you forgot to mention Brandon Tanev, by the way, in terms of your Conn Smythe nominees.
I like that. Tanev has been clutch for the Jets. Evgeny Kuznetsov, we talked about him a couple of segments ago. He's got to be in the conversation. And if the Predators do advance, mm-hmm. Philip Forsberg, mm-hmm. we talked about mm-hmm. him in the first couple of segments, Drew, but Philip Forsberg's got 8 goals as well here in the playoffs. So he's been great. Pardon me, he's got 7 goals.
Yeah.
Scheifele's got 9, so he's the leader of all the players remaining. So it's going to be a great race, and I think, we saw one of the best Hart Trophy races during the regular season, And as we talked about, the fact that, you know, most of the top scorers are already out just means it's going to be completely wide open, and we'll see what happens in the Eastern Conference and Western Conference Finals. But right now, I don't think there is maybe, you know, that front runner, unless you want to say that it's Fleury or Ovechkin.
While we are on the subject of...
And I guess we are.
Yeah. While we are on the subject of the Eastern Conference, I never did ask you guys for predictions on the Lightning Capitals. That series will obviously get underway on Friday night.
That's a tough one.
After the Jets Predators series, Game 7, and of course Game 1 of the Western Conference Final.
There's no way that one's that's going to be a 5-gamer.
Which
one? That's going to go 6 or 7 for sure.
The Tampa Washington one?
Well, that's what you asked about.
Yeah, that's what I'm asking you about right now. Is the Tampa Washington series? You think it goes long?
Yes.
You know, I don't see it.
Are you going to take the Caps in 5?
I'm not going to take the Caps in 5.
You're going to take the Lightning in 5?
I'm going to take the Lightning in 5.
In 5?
Yeah.
Really?
Wow.
I don't see how Washington...
We're going to put that on the board right there.
Put it on a board.
We're going to put it on Huss's board.
Put it on Huss's board.
Or is that Westy's board?
I'm not sure whose board that is. I'm not even sure there's a board behind me that you're pointing at.
There's a picture of Westy there.
Oh, okay. Maybe then I guess it is there. West. Yeah, there's a lot of pictures of Westwood around the studio. I don't see how the Capitals match up. Unless Braden Holtby is otherworldly.
Unless,
I don't see how he matches, especially
he's
with...
He's been pretty good the first two rounds.
I know he's been very good. But with Backstrom's status up
two.
In the air, no Burakovsky, and who knows when he's back, the Lightning...
Burakovsky's not as big of a deletion as Backstrom.
But he's a top six, top nine player on the Capitals. I just don't see how the Caps match up against the Lightning. And I don't see any flaws in this Lightning team.
Yeah, we've been talking a lot about depth over the show, and you look at this Lightning roster, and I'm just not sure how...
John, maybe I'll take the Lightning in 5. Drew's got a pretty convincing argument there.
Find me a weakness on that Lightning team.
No, even their rookies, like Anthony Cirelli, Yanni Gourde, playing pretty reliable hockey.
And they've been healthy. So maybe if they were to get an injury bug, but they've been probably the healthiest of all the teams in the playoffs right now. And that top six defense, I mean... You know, Sergachev and Coburn is sort of your third pairing. Well, they've been very solid in the first two rounds of the playoffs. Right now, the Lightning just don't look like a team with any weaknesses whatsoever to my eye.
Yeah, we know how good the top two lines are there with Stamkos, Miller, and Kucherov on the top line. Then you've got Andre Palat, Point, and Johnson on the second line. That third line was really good in the series against the Devils, and they were good in the second round as well against the Bruins. That was Killorn, Cirelli, and Yanni Gourde, who actually had an assist after his wife... gave birth to their child. I don't know if you guys saw that, but
and
Yanni
John
Gourde,
Carlson got a goal when his wife gave birth to his child.
What a great day.
I'm going to go, Drew, with the Lightning in this series, but I'm going to say Lightning in 7.
Okay, a little bit more conservative than I appreciate it, Shawnee.
And I'll go right down the middle.
I think that's conservative.
Well, I don't know.
I think it's going to be a long series.
Okay, fair enough. I mean, that's how it would a 7-game series would look like.
And I'll say Lightning.
If the Lightning beat Capitals in 5, I am going to be so unhappy.
You know, you better hope.
Because that just proves that Drew knows more about hockey than I do.
You better hope that your kid comes early. Otherwise, you're going to have to listen to me talk about it for weeks on end. Unless you're, you know, off, of course, on a legal curve parental leave, which isn't the thing that exists. Quickly, before we wrap it up with Rory and giving me the signal, Thursday night, Jets-Preds, Game 7, what do you think?
I'm not going to make a prediction on that one. I hope the Jets can pull it out. It should be a fantastic game. I'm not going to make a prediction because this series has been too close, but I do hope that the Jets are able to pull it out and advance to the next round against Vegas.
Shawnee?
I literally have no idea how to predict the score, but I took Preds in 7 to start.
Not going to change now.
But with home... Ice, I gotta stick with my original gut, Preds in 7.
There you go. That's it for this Tuesday night edition of NHL This Week. The final segment, I should mention, was brought to you by Keener Jerseys, so check them out, keenerjerseys.com. Check out their showroom at 982 Portage Avenue. A big thank you to all of our guests. We were joined by Jeff O'Neill, Dan Duva, and Joe Smith. In case you missed any of those interviews, in case you missed any of the show, it's available for download on illegalcurve.com. Also available wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe, get it sent to your device each and every week. Big props to producer Rory, doing a great job behind the board. Big thank you to our sponsors, Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, Linden Market Dental Center, Bernstein's Deli, Zapia Group Realty, and Keener Jerseys. Support them because they support Illegal Curve Hockey. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/IllegalCurve, and our website is IllegalCurve.com. For Sean Asor, for Ezra Ginsberg, I'm your host, Drew Mandel. Until Saturday at 9 a.m., we wish you good night and good luck.
As long as we stick together as a team, we'll be all right.
This is NHL Midweek,
the podcast
on TSN 1290.ca.